good north, south, east, west thing.
you know those religious people, very concerned about their geography.
That's right.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
One more funny remark from you, Buster.
Well, let's get out of here.
Oh, please, please, don't argue anymore. You hurt everybody's...
Look, we figured it 17 different ways. And every time we figured it, it was no good. Because no matter how we figured it, somebody didn't like the way we figured it.
Hello, everybody. How are y'all doing? How are you doing today? It is episode 96 of Recotopia. I'm Chris Atkinson, and how are you two guys doing?
I'm doing well. How about you, Aaron?
I am here. I am conscious and doing very well. Thank you.
Jeremy Scott and Aaron Dice are with us, and we also have our chat here with us today. One person thinks that I'm 4'6". I don't know if I can confirm or deny that rumor.
I have to say this since we're talking about height. I blew my wife's mind yesterday by telling her Elizabeth Debicki was 6'3". She had no clue how tall she was, and there was the whole "let Elizabeth Debicki be tall" movement that I support in that's going on. But it's so funny what movies can do to change that, because we were watching The Crown. She's Princess Di on The Crown.
Yeah,
and Princess Di was tall, but she was not that tall.
No,
she's a goddess, or as the British would say, a goddess.
Yes.
Anyway, today's big recommend is going to be It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World from 1963. But we will start off with our small recommends. Anybody got any small recommends to talk about today?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Well, I have a non-movie, non-food small recommend. And I emailed this small recommend to Chris the day after I discovered it a couple weeks ago. Now I'm sharing it with the world, especially if you have cats. And it is the Cheerable Self-Moving Cat Toy Ball. All right, so I've got
quite,
one in my
quite
hand
a name
here. And you just
oh,
you
that's
remove
tiny.
This little rubber thing. It's the size of a golf ball. And it charges USB. And so then you turn it on and it moves by itself. So like if I shake it, well, there it goes. You hear that on my desk? It's bouncing all over the place, propelling itself. I don't know what the voodoo technology is inside this thing. And there are several other brands. I don't know who's knocking off who. This is the one I bought. That's why I'm recommending it. My cats are mesmerized by this thing. It was billed to me as something they would play with. It moves by itself, and then it stops for a little and turns yellow. And if a cat comes up to it and bats it when it's yellow, it turns red again and starts running away. My cats don't bat at it. They just stare at it and follow it all around the house and stare at it. And as I said to Chris in my email, if your cats ever are all up in your shit and you're trying to do something, this is the only thing I found that reliably, consistently, over and over again, gets them out of my hair for 30 to 45 minutes. This model, I guess there's a newer model that does better on carpet. This model will sometimes spin in place on carpet, but then an hour later, it'll work itself free, and I'll hear it banging across the hallway again. Whatever this costs, it's worth 10 times what I paid for it in the freedom I've received from my cats up in my shit. I bought the Cheerable Ball M1 on Amazon. I can't recommend it enough. There you go.
I bought something similar for my children a few years back, and it worked in much the same way.
Was it called the Nintendo Switch?
Kept them occupied. No, it was actually a drone that was like self-propelling and would come back to you and, you know, whatever, and it would just fly around the room. I mean, it had like 10-minute flight time or whatever before it had to be recharged, but but yeah, it would keep them occupied in much the same way. So yeah, I highly recommend. My small recommend is Wonka, number one movie at the box office.
I didn't think there was any chance this was good.
You know, you're not alone. I've heard that from a lot of people, and I think that's this when when a movie like this happens, what's interesting is I think most of us go into it going, there's no way this is possibly good, whatever. And then it's actually kind of good. And so because of expectations, you're like, I love this movie. Mm. And so there's, I think it's like an 85% on Rotten Tomatoes on Top Critics. So like it's certainly the critical acclaim is there. I really enjoyed it. I am apt to enjoy musicals. I think there is the Paddington effect here. It's the same guy who did the Paddington movies, and you can feel that warmth and heart in here, and it just works. I actually teared up 3 times during this movie. That's how good he is at just kind of bringing the humanity into something. One of the main complaints I've heard is that this Wonka doesn't feel anything like Wonka is supposed to be, like, which is, you know, kind of this, you know, embittered, you know, person. But I think this is a good origin story for that character. Like, you can see how he would go from this character, not trying to give a lot away about, you know, what this character has happened to him in this movie. But you can see how he would go from the person in this movie to the Gene Wilder type character. So I really, really like this. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
So I've been loving late career Hugh Grant for the last 4 or 5 years.
Yes.
But I just read last week in an interview promoting this movie, he finds acting excruciating.
He, like, hates it so much.
And it makes me sad to know that, because it feels like especially in Paddington 2 and Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves, it feels like he's having a blast, but apparently it's the exact opposite.
Same here. It feels like he's having a blast here, and he clearly did not. He did not enjoy all the Oompa Loompa makeup.
That just makes him even better actor, I guess.
I guess. Like, yeah.
He ended the interview basically saying, I just hope my kids like this one. Whereas, like, I guess the Paddington 2 scared the bejesus out of him or something.
Oh, interesting.
Didn't like seeing him be the villain, whereas here he'll be the Oompa Loompa, which is less scary to their kids. I don't know. Mm. Anyway.
I imagine the second wave of people seeing this will be, no, it's actually bad. I imagine that's the second wave that's coming, because that's usually how it goes, because then the expectations go up, and then because it's only kind of good, then it's like, eh, whatever, you know, it was mad or whatever. But I don't know. Everybody has their own experience. My experience was great. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. My small recommend is Dream Scenario, starring Nicolas Cage.
I'm curious about this movie.
Yeah, this movie is quite a lot of fun, and I think it has some things to say too. So everybody in this world, not quite everybody in this world is having dreams about Nicolas Cage. And this isn't meta. He's just a normal dude in this. He's not Nicolas Cage. Although in some ways you can kind of, you can still kind of be like, it's Nicolas Cage. But there are people who are having dreams about him, but the thing about it is they're so ordinary in the fact that how he shows up. They're almost always a situation when the person is in danger and he shows up and does nothing in the dream. He does absolutely nothing. And that is what every dream is like. And he's a professor at this college. His class starts getting popular because all these people start having these shared experiences of having him in the dream. There's a whole montage of people talking about their dreams where they're in trouble and danger, like bleeding out or whatever, and he just shows up in the dream, just stands there, and that's it. That's the end of the dream. He becomes famous enough that he's thinking, oh, well, I might be able to write this book about, and he teaches something like biology or something like that. And that's his subject that he wants to teach. He wants to write this book about it. And he already thinks that one of his ideas has been stolen by somebody he used to be with, and that, you know, that they've stolen his thunder and everything. And he hopes that he's going to be able to write this book. And he finally actually does encounter some people who want to do something with him, but they don't really want to do anything having to do with a biology book or anything like that. They want to put him in like Coke commercials or something. I can't remember the exact brand, but it's basically like, oh, everybody's got this shared feeling of this guy being in their dreams and everything. Why doesn't he show up in a Coke commercial or whatever? And it's like, you know, the drink of your dreams or whatever like that. Michael Cera plays the head of this agency or whatever, and he's hilarious in it. It's exactly how those meetings go, by the way, where you give them ideas and they just kind of like nod at you like, yeah, okay, let me write some notes down about that or whatever. There happens to be one person there who is having different kinds of dreams about Nicolas Cage, though, and those are sexy dreams. And at this point, a certain set of events occurs where, once this is over, he starts coming in and terrorizing people in their dreams. There's a turning point after this is discovered. And once he starts terrorizing people in his dreams, everything that he thinks is going his way starts going downhill. And there are some discussions about cancel culture and things like that in this movie. I know that is kind of a charged term, but I think it has some thoughtful things to say about cancel culture in it. I don't think it's one of those where it's going on bad faith or anything like that. But this is a very, very good movie. Nicolas Cage, talk about somebody who's had a great late career renaissance or whatever you want to call it. I think Dream Scenario is another one. And if you've been liking him in the movies the past 5 years, he's just great in this
too. I think he's phenomenal in this. I think it's one of his best performances. I think he's really, really good here. Mm-hmm. I think that metaphor about fame, it's a real fame kind of like when you, there's this whole thing at the beginning of the movie about zebras, right? And this idea that, you know, the stripes on a zebra are to camouflage it to each other, not to the world around it, so that it just looks like one big mass. Because when you stick your head up out of the herd, that's when you can get attacked. And so that's the entire metaphor of the movie, is all of a sudden he has stuck his head up out of the herd and what happens to him because of that. And it is a commentary on fame culture and those kind of things. And I think as this movie is great. It works, you know, as that really, really well. So and it's a really interesting movie. And there's a scene involving the young woman who finds him sexually attractive in her jeans that may be the cringiest, most amazing scene I saw all year. It's so good. It speaks to something I don't know that I've ever seen a movie speak to so clearly. In that scene,
it's kind of in a way like Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray is trying to recreate Andy McDowell stuff when they're throwing the snowballs and everything. It's kind of like that.
So. It's similar to that. Yeah, it's so good.
You guys have officially bumped this up my list.
It's also
this is such a Jeremy movie.
I also believe this is slightly based on a true story. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I believe this was a true phenomenon that happened with someone where there was a mass delusion of dreaming of them kind of thing that this is kind of jumps off
of. It was
Max
Headroom.
It was, indeed.
Clearly. Max Headroom. Okay. A Dream Scenario, I think, is in theaters right now. I don't know if it's streaming yet. I saw it in theaters 2 or 3 weeks ago, I believe, but it should be soon. I'm assuming it's soon. It'll be on some sort of streaming service. So check your real goods. Check your apps that tell you all the things and stuff, you know. Anyway, all right, so the big recommend for this episode.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
It's a mad, 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 mad world. I did leave out a mad when I said it the first time. Someone called me out on it. And it's funny to me. The director, Stanley Kramer, wanted to put a fifth mad, apparently, in this title.
They just kept adding them.
And didn't put the fifth mad in it. And apparently he regretted it. Not putting the fifth one in. Stanley Kramer. It's a director we haven't talked about much, and I don't know why, because he had a legendary run there from the 50s and 60s especially, and he had done movies like The Defiant Ones and Inherit the Wind and Judgment at Nuremberg, and Spencer Tracy has been a part of a lot of these movies that he directed, and maybe his most famous movie is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which came out later, but He wanted to make a movie that was not serious at all. He had made so many just dead serious movies and everything, so he wanted to finally do this. And apparently he tried to get everybody funny that he could possibly find in this movie. Some people couldn't do it because of scheduling conflicts, some people couldn't do it because they asked for too much money, and there's other reasons that certain people were not in this. But man, they got a lot of people in this ultimately. So unfamiliar with the story, so here you go. A man by the name of Smiler Grogan, played by Jimmy Durant, is speeding through a little highway system on a cliff, and he is going way, way too fast, and his car ends up going over the cliff, and there are four interested parties who go down and check and see if he's okay. He just happens to be still alive on this cliff. They come down and walk down to it. And so who do we have who all come down here? We have Milton Berle playing J. Russell Finch. He's a seaweed food business owner of some sort. They decided to give him the weeniest thing possible, because that's kind of what he is in this movie. He's a weenie. He's a very agreeable about everything, and he's got a very young wife named Emmeline, played by Dorothy Provine. But the person who really is just like just the person who probably has whittled him down over the years is his mother-in-law, Mrs. Marcus, played by Ethel Merman, who is constantly yelling through this movie, constantly yelling about something. She never dials it down. It's kind of funny. then we have another group, but it's a couple. Sid Caesar plays Melville Crump, who is a dentist, and his wife, Monica, played by Edie Adams. I believe this was supposed to be Ernie Kovacs at one point. Edie Adams was married to Ernie Kovacs, but Ernie Kovacs died in a car crash months before filming. She had to be talked into doing this movie. She ended up saying this would be the right thing to do, so she did. They're a couple that's driving to someplace. And then you have Mickey Rooney, who plays Ding Bell. I don't think this is ever actually stated in the movie that his name is Ding Bell. Does he say it once? Okay. I don't know. Okay. And then, his buddy Hackett plays Benji Benjamin. and then finally we have the one loner of the group, Pike, played by Jonathan Winters. He's a truck driver. He has got a whole bunch of furniture and things in his truck. They go down to see if Smiler Grogan is okay. He's definitely about to die. In fact, he literally kicks a bucket at one point down the cliff. But before he dies, he says, "There's this dough, see? 350 G's." And he tells them that it's under this big W in Santa Rosita Park. And I don't know if I don't think Santa Rosita is a real place, but apparently it's close to San Diego in the, he tells them about that just before he dies. We have cops coming down. One is played by Norman Fell of Three's Company fame. If you ever watched that, he came into that later. He asked them if he said anything or whatever. I think there was a really funny, there's a funny line where Jonathan Winters says, "About what?" And he goes, "What do you mean about what?" And it's like, did he say anything? And so they kind of stumble around and they don't reveal that they've been told about this money. So they go up, they all pretend like they're going to go. After they get done with the cops, they all pretend like they're going to, just go their separate ways and do their vacations or wherever they're going and everything. But nobody really trusts that. And for a second there, all four of the cars are just driving it single file down this highway, making sure one doesn't do something out of the ordinary. At some point, I think it's Milton Berle, the Finch character, who's pushed to go faster, or is it Sid Caesar? I can't remember which one it was. He's pushed to go faster, and they all go after him because they're like, all right, he's going to go after that money. So everybody's kind of like on edge. They all want to go for the money. I don't know what Jonathan Winters is doing. He slows down and he stays behind I don't know what he's actually trying to do there. I don't, maybe you guys have an idea.
I mean, my guess was that he was trying to fall behind and then find his own route to try and get there faster.
I guess, but it all seems to be set up to be a joke, basically, where he stops and then he creeps around the rock. And of course, all of them are just standing there like, what are you doing? And when he tries to explain, he's about to say what he was doing, but then he doesn't say it. So I don't think they even had an answer, really. I mean, maybe he wanted to back up at some point. I don't
know. He knew he couldn't win any kind of, you know, race in that truck he was in. So he was going to try to find a different route. I think that's all it was.
Yeah. Just turn around then. he stops his truck. Yeah. So then let's all be reasonable, right? Let's actually like decide how this is going to be divvied up when we find the money and everything. And they first, it's a very reasonable thing. It's let's split it up amongst the cars. But every time they bring something up, they're just like, nobody likes it because they're like, I don't get as much as this person does, and so on and so forth. When we come back to them, this movie starts intercutting between a lot of stories at this point, because we go to Spencer Tracy and we see what he's doing. But at some point they want to do a thing where it's like, whoever went down the hill and whoever was in the car, and each car gets a share, and person in the car gets the share. And there's the only sensible one is Ethel Merman's like, let's just split it eight ways, which is would have been the perfect thing. But they just don't trust her because she's a woman, and they keep calling her an old bag and all this other stuff. And Buddy Hackett's like, we figured it 17 different ways, and every time we figured it was no good. And so they're like, so now it's every man, including the old bag for himself. And this is my favorite part of the movie. Mickey Rooney says, except you, lady, may you just drop dead. And then Jonathan Winters comes in and says, all right, we all agree on that.
This movie hates that woman's character.
It does. And she, a lot of the humor comes not only from her constant criticizing and everything, but she falls over and doubles over several times in this movie. Like this, I think there's like five or six times she falls over, ass over tit, as they say.
Or is held upside down to shake the keys out of her bosom.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, at some point we cut to the police detective, the main police detective, T.G. Culpepper, who's played by Spencer Tracy. He's about to retire. He wants a bigger pension for himself, but also he's hoping to take down the Smiler Grogan case, which is a tuna factory robbery. It's a $350,000 tuna factory robbery. So he wants to take down the Smiler Grogan case just before he retires.
He hasn't even working on it. Doesn't he tell his wife he's been working on it for like two decades?
15 years he's
and
been
this
working
guy's driving
on this.
Around with cash in his car. That's wild.
Yeah, I know. He wants to take this case down. Now, if you've seen any movie, you know why he wants to take this down. They intersperse a lot of like moments where he's kind of daydreaming. You see him looking at Mexico on the map and all that. In the longer version, which by the way, that's a whole other discussion about this movie, the longer version, which they have tried to piece together lost footage over the years and everything. You actually see him planning about this when he talks to Buster Keaton, who gets kind of short shrift in this movie. When they actually do show Buster Keaton, you may have blinked and missed him. In fact, that's how little he is in the 2.5 hour version. There's a lot of negatives to watching either version, and there's positives to watching either version. But I agree.
I watched both versions, and this is the most prep I've ever done for a movie on this show. Six mm-hmm. hours of movie watching or whatever. But I did watch both versions, and we can have a discussion on the differences and such. But I think it boiled down to me was the longer version. The positive is you get a lot better motivations for a lot of the actions. Mm-hmm. Like there are motivations in the shorter version that you don't like. I couldn't understand that I understood in the longer version.
Right.
And it has some interesting like artifacts like the police calls at the intermission. Like, I don't mm-hmm. know, like they're police calls that they played at the theater, like over all the speakers during the intermission. So like it would update you on like the different sections of the movie, how it was going while you were on intermission. That's kind of interesting mm-hmm. and fun. So yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yes, you get the full widescreen version of it, which, you know, the 2.5 version, half an hour version is the pan and scan, which has cut out actual entire characters on the screen. I don't know how much that damaged the movie for me once I watched the longer version and I was able to see the difference and everything. The Three Stooges thing is pretty egregious, though.
It's crazy. There's a whole Stooge left out on the pan and scan version.
Left out on the pan and scan. So yeah,
I watched somebody on the Discord found this on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it was 2.5 hours and 39 minutes, 35
yeah,
minutes.
there are 2.5 hour versions that have the full framing.
All Three Stooges were there for me, and I was more offended by how little time they spent on set for this movie, because if I had been looking the wrong direction, not directly at the screen for those 3 seconds, I would have missed them. But they were all there for the version that I saw.
Basically
the decision at the police station is we're going to follow these four groups of people. We're not going to arrest them. We're going to see where they go. And then we'll arrest them once they start digging up this place where Smiler Grogan told them to. So these four groups, the first stop is an airfield. The Crumps win the old beat up plane that they've gone to go to. They think that they're going to be able to fly to Santa Rosita in this plane and beat everybody. Of course, this plane is a death trap. nobody should pay any money to fly in this plane. And there's even a point where they look down and they see the cars whizzing past them on the road underneath them. So they aren't actually getting anywhere fast.
Although they do arrive anyways, a long time before everybody else, so that was interesting.
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, I guess he does pay the guy some money to go faster, which is takes more fuel or whatever. But it's still like the timing of everybody getting there, you know, at the same time doesn't seem quite right, but hey, it's a movie that we're watching, who cares, right? So they've decided to follow the people. The first stop is an airfield. Crumps win the plane. It's built in 1916, by the way. He's told before he's about to get up there, and this woman on the airfield does the north, south, east, west thing, whatever.
Yes, that's what it is.
The north, yes, south, east, west thing.
you know, those religious people, very concerned about their geography.
She draws the letter lowercase t on her chest.
Yes, exactly. The lowercase t, that's what she does. The other three groups have to figure out what they're going to do. Of course, two of the groups, there's a wreck between Pike and the Finch clan, so their cars are completely out of the loop. And then Ding and Benji decide to drive to another airfield, like a private airfield, I guess.
Yeah, like high class kind of place.
Yeah, high class one, where they're going to run into Tyler Fitzgerald, played by Jim Backus. Now, an interesting thing about this movie is that it came out, I guess, a month after Gilligan's Island premiered. So I think a lot of people at this point know Jim Backus from Gilligan's Island as Thurston Howell III, but maybe not, like, it's not really entrenched in everybody at this point yet.
Right.
Maybe it is. Yeah. I don't know. But he's kind of playing that same kind of person. He's a rich drunk. And I don't know if that's what he was before, you know, and he's just known for this and that's what he was always doing. But they end up harassing this guy to get on his. Now we're going back and forth. Pike takes a child's bicycle out of his truck and starts trying to. He ends up running into this other motorist played by Otto Meyer. His name is Otto Meyer, played by Phil Silver. Phil Silver hears the story and then tricks Pike and drives off without him. And then the Finch clan, they wave down this British guy who's like a cactus wrangler of some sort. I don't know. He likes collecting cacti. His name is J. Algernon Hawthorne. He's played by Terry Thomas, who's got an unusual name, because Terry Thomas, you'd think that's two names, but it's a hyphenated Terry Tom. I don't know how that works. And then so he was originally supposed to be
Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers,
who was one of the ones mentioned for wanting too much money. He did not want to do it for what they were offering. So yeah,
so there's a point where they're driving with him, and Mrs. Marcus remembers that she has a son that lives near Santa Rosita, and she slaps Hawthorne on the back while he's driving. Of course, this leads to a a giant wreck, because everything that they do in this movie ends up being a car wreck at some point, and they have to go get his car fixed, and they end up promising him 10%. At this point, Mrs. Marcus is trying to call her son, Sylvester, who is a, guess, a beatnik of some sort. He's a lifeguard. It's one of the most unusual scenes in the movie. It's this woman dancing in a bikini, and it's just like this very straightforward, like no emotion dance to something. And Sylvester's sitting there like, yeah, baby, yeah. And just, he's like the most excited that someone could ever be at someone so stoically dancing. They just don't hear the phone for like a couple of times. It takes like three times for her to get him on the phone finally. Anyway, that's much later in the movie. Of course, and we're going back to Otto Meyer, the Phil Silvers character. He's driving away from Pike because he just tricked him and everything, but his tire blows and he goes to this garage and he goes out and tells the guys to do whatever they can to get his car back up and everything. This lets Pike come back and catch up with him, and then there's this big fight where apparently Jonathan Winters did some damage to Phil Silvers in this fight. He actually hurt him during this thing. He slams him up against this gas pump and like all sorts of stuff, and we start to believe that Pike is like in the Incredible Hulk or something in this movie, because he has the strength of 100 men.
Oh, he's for sure the strong, sensitive guy. Like he's the, that's what he's supposed to be.
Yes. Yes. At some point he gets the garage mechanics to hold on to him, and they wrap this barrier of some sort around him or whatever, and he says he's a psychopathic killer, there's going to be somebody that comes by to pick him up later, and you know, thanks guys or whatever, and he drives off. And this leads to Pike destroying this gas station. This is probably one of the most famous scenes of this movie, because Pike gets out of his restraints and he fights these garage mechanics, and everything is just, you know, smash somebody through a wall or like punch through something. And like the garage is not a garage at the end, of this fight. Pike ends up taking a tow truck, out of this thing. And by the way, I'm sure you will notice that they probably do far more damage than $350,000. In this movie to get $350,000 by the end of it. So let's see,
the future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And Benji, they're trying to get Tyler Fitzgerald. And so he's a drunk. They can't get him up at first. They put him in a shower, or he goes to take a shower or whatever. He finally agrees to take him in the air, but he's way more interested in drinking than flying the plane. That's going to lead, of course, he's going to end up going in. He's going to give the controls to Benji, and he's going to go back and he's going to try to make an old fashioned. And while Benji is trying to hold on to the wheel or the whatever, he actually makes the plane move in such a way that Tyler hits his head and he's unconscious. And now you have two people who don't know how to fly a plane.
Some of my favorite stuff is them trying to land that plane in the control room, and then just buzzing the control room. So like, I think Rob Reiner's in the control room. Carl Reiner. Yes. Yeah. Previous generation Reiner.
Right.
I found all of that really, really funny.
Why don't we just shoot him down and be done with it?
Yeah. Yes. I love this little cut to Culpepper where he starts talking to his wife about flying to Hawaii and celebrate the retirement. And then they're not going to take their daughter, Billy Sue. Billy Sue is set to be engaged. Something happens to that. And she says, apparently the mom says, well, she's 6'5" and that that's gonna have a certain problem with it or whatever, something like that. Billy Sue is upset. She's gonna leave home. She wants to get to a bus station. She doesn't want to talk to her dad. Apparently, doesn't like her dad very much. And then later on, Billy Sue's on the phone, and his wife is on another, and he has the phones pointed at each other so that she and her mom can talk while he just sits there. And he's just like, fuck my life, basically. I can't wait till I get this 350 G's and go to Mexico, basically, the whole time. This is one of the most curious parts of the movie, is that Otto inexplicably picks up a hitchhiker. Like, knowing Otto's character throughout this movie, he may be the most deplorable person in all of them, I think. I'm surprised he even pulls over. Honestly, yes. But he picks up a hitchhiker who wants to take medicine to his wife. He's broken down. He needs to take medicine to his wife. And then he takes the car off road, and Otto can't get back up the hill. So he gets this kid to help him out of the area. And he ends up driving up this mountain and then taking the car down this long slope. And when he gets down there's nothing but a stream. And the kid says it's shallow enough and just drive over it. Of course it's not shallow enough, and Otto gets the car into the stream, and he just ends up floating away. And basically, I think he ends up like crashing somewhere, and he's on foot after that happens. And apparently, Silver's nearly died. He nearly drowned during this.
Wow.
Scene. Apparently, he can't swim.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that people just give any fucks about what they did to make movies. Even in this era of movies, yep. They're still doing shit like that.
Everyone was Tom Cruise back then. Just think of it that way. Yeah. Everyone was Tom Cruise.
What's funny you say that is that one of the notes that I wrote down in the trivia section of IMDb is that there were only about 100 stunt performers in the U.S. at this time, and 80 of them worked on this movie.
Yes. Insane. Crazy.
That's insane.
Insane.
So Pike is in the tow truck now. He ends up finding Mrs. Marcus and her daughter stranded on the side of the road. I'm kind of skipping over a little bit. Miss Marcus has a fight, and Aaron alluded to it. She puts the keys down in her dress because she wants to call Sylvester, and they don't. And then they just hold her upside down to get the keys out. They don't go drive off somewhere. I think they still need to fix his truck, I guess. I think that's what the tire is still wobbly on it. And so that's what they go do. So while Mrs. Marcus and her daughter are sitting there, Pike comes by in his tow truck. And then so they're like, I want to call Sylvester. So he takes them to the gas station. Of course, they go to the exact gas station where Milton Berle is. And they drive out just as they're coming in, so they don't see each other. So, there's so many things to in this movie. Let's see.
We haven't talked about Sid Caesar getting trapped in the. Yeah, that's
because it's all contained into one thing. I wanted to like talk about all that in there. In fact, I'm actually just about to get to that. Finch and Hawthorne drive back to find his mother-in-law and wife, but they're not there. So that leads to them trying to find each other and everything. And meanwhile, at some point, she does get Sylvester on the phone. And she tells him this rapid story. He's stoned, obviously. That's what they're trying to say, I think, on this whole thing. She tells him this wild story, but tells him to stay there because just listen to me. And of course, he doesn't listen to anything she says except for the fact that she's in trouble. So he gets in this car. Now, in the long version, you find out he has stolen the girl in the bikini's car, and the girl in the bikini is married, so they're like having an affair of some sort. Wow. But he steals her car, so that's what happens next. He goes in there, so you got three groups basically all converging on each other. So the Crumps, after they miraculously survived this plane and everything, they need a pickaxe and a shovel. So they go to this hardware store, and so they go in there right as it's closing, and they go down to this basement to find the pickaxe and the shovel. But the owner, who doesn't know that they're in there, locks the door behind them and then walks out. Now they're locked into this basement. And what follows is, a comedy of errors of them trying to get out of this basement. He tries a sledgehammer on the door. He tries to trip the burglar alarm that doesn't work at all. He tries to use a blowtorch on the doorknob. The blowtorch ends up setting fire to the basement. This is where we and then a fire gets started, but it gets pulled out. It gets put out, and then they have dynamite down there. The first long fuse that they put in there, it's an extraordinarily comically long fuse. It gets extinguished, but it lights a box of fireworks. So there's fireworks that get shot down there. And then the second fuse blows a hole into a laundromat and they are finally free. So they end up wrecking the whole store, of course, because nothing goes unfazed in this whole thing. And the Crumps end up getting a taxi driven by Peter Falk by the end of it. And they are making their way to Santa Rosita. So then we have Tyler Fitzgerald. We've already talked about that. And we've already talked about Carl Reiner. And that's where the Three Stooges cameo happens, because they're waiting for the plane to crash and put the fire out and everything. We end up having where Sylvester notices Finch on the road. They get in a big, huge wreck. The Pike and the tow truck come by, so they all jump into the tow truck at this point, and then they go to Santa Rosita. Otto ends up flagging down Don Knotts, who now I'm not familiar with whether Don, I know he had done, he know Andy Griffith's show was strong at this point, so a lot of people knew him with this. I don't know if he was known for other stuff other than Andy Griffith at this point. I'm not familiar with that, but
he's done a lot of Disney stuff, like mm-hmm. Apple Dumpling Gang and that kind of stuff. So yeah, he was a pretty known comedic person,
and he's apparently playing one of his famous like characters in this, the extremely nervous man or something, right, like yeah. that. Otto once again tricks somebody into getting out of the car so that he can now steal the car. He suggests that the helicopter is following them, much like Ray Liotta in Goodfellas. He gets very paranoid about the helicopters. He gets Don Knotts out of the car. So he drives to Santa Rosita in this. Now Culpepper has convinced the whole police department they need to stay away from Santa Rosita so he can steal the money. And then he's going to confront the treasure seekers. I don't know if his decision to go full crook was because the pension didn't go through, or if he's always been thinking about doing this. I mean,
I think it's because the pension didn't go through. I think the movie is going that direction. Yeah.
Yeah. The movie suggests that he is at least dreaming about being someplace else all the way through it. But then he asked for that pension, and that pension doesn't come through. In an ironic twist of fate, he is told that it's never going to go through because the politicians are mad at him, and so he's never going to get it. And then he goes out and he's going to do this crime. And while he does it, his captain actually successfully gets a tripled pension while he's doing this, he's about to steal all this money and everything. So, that nice little ironic touch in this movie. Ding and Benji end up doing just enough to land and crash the plane without getting hurt. They end up taking a taxi. So now everybody has converged on Santa Rosita. Everyone looks for the W. It ends up being a bunch of palm trees that form a W. By the way, if you've ever seen The Simpsons, called Homer the Vigilante, they do a whole thing on It's a Mad, 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 Mad World on that, where the Sam Neill burglar tells them that there's a treasure buried under a big T, and everybody goes and does this. They have scenes from the movie, basically, that happen right after that, including the one where the kid waves to Phil Silvers as he's in the car floating down the river and everything. Bart is the kid in this version. And of course they end up going to the T and digging up something that has absolutely no money. So they're looking for this big W. The first to see it is Finch's wife, and he and Culpepper just happens to be in the area. This seemed to like make the movie longer for me. There's no point in her finding this first, because nothing happens with it. And I don't think anything could happen with it, even if that's the case, because she can't do it by herself. She's not going to be able to dig by herself or anything like that. And of course, while she's sitting there dreaming about leaving the country and joining a convent of all things, the other people find the big W, and so they dig this up. It's a suitcase full of money, just like Smiler Grogan said. Culpepper ends up revealing he's a cop, and he tells everyone to turn themselves in so he can just kind of make off with the money. After that, though, they all pile in the taxi, and they figure out he's probably a crook, because why would they let them off so easily? And so they decide to follow him. And Culpepper ends up driving this car to a marina. This is where Buster Keaton shows up in the movie. If you saw the shorter version, this is the only part where he shows up in the movie. In fact, the longer version doesn't even have the footage, I don't think. It's like
some still shots and then the audio of the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So the movie ends up kind of taking him out, and it kind of sucks, but you know, it's kind of cool to see him show up in a movie in the 1960s. When Culpepper tries to park his car at this marina, the taxis show up and he knows he can't hide. So he drives out of there. And once he drives out of there, he goes back towards town. And this is where all of his cop buddies see him driving, and they now realize that Culpepper's a crook, and so everybody in the world is chasing him into downtown Santa Rosita, and this leads to him running into a building. He goes up some stairs, everybody follows him into the building, they go up on a fire escape, there's too many people on the fire escape, it breaks off of the side of the building. Fire truck comes over and tries to put this big ladder there, and the guy's like, not everybody at once, it can only be one at a time. But everybody, of course, they're selfish bastards, get on the fire ladder at the same time, and they cause the fire ladder to start moving all over the place. And they're the things that happen to them as they get slung off this ladder are hilarious. I mean, they all should have died.
Oh yeah.
But it's just hilarious. Like when we see the dummies flying out of the down from the screen
landing
and everything,
in Lincoln's arms.
Yeah, landing in Lincoln's arms like a styrofoam Abraham Lincoln statue. I love that whole sequence. And then it ends in Culpepper crashing into a pet store where he is licked by a dog one time, but yes. Then the movie backs and forth. They either couldn't get the dog to lick him more, or he refused to get licked more. I don't know which one it is, but it's an interesting, it's kind of funny. It's like funny to, it's like almost like they did that in editing and they're like, that's kind of funny. And they just kind of left it in. Of course, all of them end up in the hospital. They're all in the same room, of course, bandaged up like mummies everywhere. And Culpepper tells everybody that, you know, you guys are going to be fine because the judge is going to throw the book at me on this. And I've lost my pension. My wife's going to divorce me. I'm going to go to jail. I'll probably never laugh again. And Buddy Hackett throws a banana peel onto the floor. And Ethel Merman, making one more appearance to come in and tell everybody I told you so and whatnot, comes in and slips on the banana peel, and everybody busts out laughing, including Culpepper at the end, who's resistant at first, but it's just too funny, so he finally ends up laughing. And there is your movie. I know
they're clearly meant to be like chimpanzees in a zoo in that like last year. Like, yes. Some of them are like hopping up and down. Like it's you know, clearly, you know, humanity is a mess. It's good stuff.
Yep.
All right. So what did you guys think? I know that actually talking about this movie took nearly the length of the movie to explain. I tried to keep it as short as possible, but what did you guys think?
I had a blast. It's hard for me to know who's who. I'm just young enough. I don't recognize everybody.
Same here.
So I had to look up a lot of them. But when Peter Falk showed up, I was like, I know that guy. I know who that guy is. I recognize that guy. I wrote down a few notes, but nothing super urgent that will change anybody's life. I just wanted to note that the continuity of all the cars, especially when cutting to green screen of people in the cars, is astounding. Mm-hmm.
Especially when you consider it was cut down, and a lot of that was, you know, they had to do an edit from the longer edit. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
I mean,
stuff.
It plays the car work like an action film would. Really, really impressed with that aspect. That was maybe the biggest takeaway for me was like how much attention and care went into that to make sure, as often as possible, the car in the background is in the background where it's supposed to be when we cut to the inside. I was really impressed.
Yeah, I love this movie. It was great rewatching it and also watching the longer version, which I'd never seen before. When I first watched this movie, I knew I was in from the second Jimmy Durante did his Dying Man performance. It just slayed me. And then he literally kicked the bucket and I was just like, oh, they made it for me. They made this movie for me. I get it. This is what we're doing. In fact, my college buddies and I will often play the treasure is buried in the you know, moment for each other, as if we're going to die, you know, before we actually reveal where it's buried. I think overall, I would sum up my love of this movie in the character work. I just think the character work in this movie is so good. Everybody, you know who everybody is. I love Milton Berle and Sid Caesar in this. I think they are so good. Sid Caesar especially. I just can't, like, even in the group scenes, I'm watching Sid Caesar. I love what his face does. I just, there's something about the way he performs that I really, really like. The Buddy Hackett, Mickey Rooney pair is so funny together. Their character work is great. And all the way down the line, Phil Silvers is a blast in this movie. Yeah, like, once so he good. Shows up, he's so good and so fun. In my trivia reading, I think it was mentioned Jonathan Winters is his first movie.
Yep.
It was the first movie that Jonathan Winters was
probably
in.
Probably why he was able to injure that other dude so severely.
He just didn't have the experience.
What seems to happen with these debuts is that they always end up in a fight scene and they end up hurting the person in the fight scene. It always seems to happen that way. Was there a favorite performer that you had in this whole thing?
For me, I think it's Sid Caesar and maybe Ethel Merman. I think she's great in that role. She does exactly what she's supposed to do. I was thinking about my favorite cameo, and there's something about that Jerry Lewis cameo that I think is so funny. It's
my
just like, just driving over the guy's hat just because he wanted to, and then the laugh as the
look he puts on his face when he sees the hat in the middle of the street, and then he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna run over that," you know.
I guess in the original showings, the Three Stooges got the biggest laugh. That was the biggest laugh for people, and I get that, but. But yeah, that Jerry Lewis one is great. I did also read the thing about the Jack Benny cameo, that he was actually wearing a bowler hat in honor of Stan Laurel, right? Because Stan Laurel wouldn't do it because he promised never to perform after Hardy died. Yeah. So I thought that was really sweet.
I guess he's doing something. There's some movie it sounds like he's doing a movie in that, that Jack Benny's doing, because it's a slow creep up in the car, and he looks like he's performing something from another movie. I don't know what it is though. My favorite performer in this is Jonathan Winters. I think it's just the expressions he does, especially like that when he's creeping across that rock, and he's like, huh, okay, are those guys around there? And then he's like, his whole face and body like contorts, and then the part where, you know, when he runs into the car, has that wreck in his truck, and there's like all these sounds that happens. He goes through like six or seven different facial expressions during that whole thing. So I really, really, really enjoyed him. I like everybody in this, but
the only other thing I wanted to mention was on a Sin Brain level was they spend, you know, so much hilarious time for Sid Caesar to get their pick and shovel, and everyone else just shows up with a shovel. They just happened to have one, or
hey, you know what? They heard that there was a secret opening in the laundromat.
That would have been hilarious if they all made stops at the laundromat and to grab shovels. That would have been funny. But
all right, it's time to come up with you guys' super secret double feature for this movie. So who wants to start?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Well, Aaron wants to start.
I guess I do. You know, there are some, because Jeremy still has to go, I'm not going to name any actual names, but there are some, you know, obvious ones that were based on this movie.
Didn't choose Rat Race, if you want to talk about Rat Race.
Okay, so Rat Race would be the primary among them, you know, kind of redoing this kind of thing. I didn't want to go that direction. I decided to go with kind of the Mad Camp big cast of comedians with a lot of comedian cameos in a life or death situation. I went with This Is the End as the double feature for Mad World. Kind of has that same energy to me, like a bunch of comedians you can tell like working together and just having fun. And then there are of course a ton of cameos in it as well, with, you know, it's just kind of that group feels to me like the modern example of just like, hey, let's bring every single friend we can think of in here to have a good time with us. I went with This Is the End.
That's beautiful. I hovered for a long time on the road trip traveling chase aspect of Mad Mad World. So I entertained road trip. I entertained the Hope and Crosby road movies, and I entertained National Lampoon's Vacation. All of those, I think, tonally would fit. But I ended up easing off of the travel aspect and going with the everyone in this movie is a horrible, selfish person. And I'm mad at you, Josh Zero, in the chat for getting this out before I did. But Michael J. Fox's Greedy from 1994.
Oh, Greedy. Wow.
Phil Hartman, Kirk,
Douglas.
And it's basically he's about to die. He's super, super wealthy, and all of his offspring come and suck up to him for days because they all want to be rich. And he's trying to decide if any of them truly love him. And when they lose the money in Mad Mad World, and the money goes everywhere, and the fireman guy comes up and says one at a time, and they can't do it, I realized this movie is not about the money. This movie is about how terribly selfish these people are. And so that's why I'm going with Greedy. I think that's
good choice.
I actually love Greedy. I haven't seen it in forever, but I love how that movie progresses towards its finale and everything. And I love I don't think if you looked at the IMDb, it probably has got like a 5.8 or something like that is my guess, but it's
6.3, but Rotten Tomatoes hates the fuck out of it. 32% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I really enjoyed it, but that's a good call. Okay, so Aaron's turn to pick for next week. What is the movie?
I had to do it. I had to show the breadth of the talent, the expanse of talent of Kramer and Spencer Tracy. So we are going to stay in the 60s and do Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah,
I love this movie. This is in my top 50 movies of all time, even though I just saw it within the last few years for the first time. This movie blew me away, so I'm excited to revisit it. And
my favorite part is when they invite the Klingons over for dinner, and Chekhov says, "Guess who's coming to dinner?" Mm-hmm.
So that's good. Yep. So you've seen it, so you'll be able to re-explore all those nuances. So we're gonna do Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
This is a great movie.
It's so good.
I haven't seen it in forever. I don't see it on a current streamer. It looks like we may have to rent this one, which is fine because this one's worth it. All right, we have obviously negative time for questions this week, so Chris, do you want to wrap us up?
Yeah, we'll wrap it up, and you know, maybe one day we'll have a movie that we can just talk about in like five words and then, you know, move on to questions or whatever. But
I'm sure next week it'll be really quick. Nothing serious to talk about in this one at all. So.
Movies in the 60s were so woke. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you, chat, for coming in and being with us all the way through this. Some really good double features in there, like Cannonball Run and Death Race 2000 showed up in there, so stuff like that. So thanks guys for listening to us and being with us here today. That's gonna do it. This is a good we'll see you next week. Guess who's coming to dinner.
Bye guys. Actually, I think 2 weeks, right? We'll see people
two weeks. We are not doing one next week
because it's Christmas for our recording week. Yeah,
that's right. So yes, it'll be in 2 weeks, but anyway, we will see you next time. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I'm reading an email from my insurance company so I'm halfway through, but it sounds like they're breaking up with me.
Oh, yeah?
You got a breakup email from your insurance company?
No, this is my home insurance company, and they're basically, the first paragraph was like, as you may have seen in the news, the insurance industry is experiencing extreme pressures on multiple fronts. Increased severity of frequency of loss, unpredictable weather patterns, and unstable reinsurance market all combined to create a historic hard market. What this might mean for you? First bullet point. Overall, higher premiums. Yes. Stricter underwriting guidelines. Increase in memos. Yes. Which means you need to show proof of remediation. Yes.
And this right after a tornado nearly hit your house?
Yeah. Well, and I don't think that's a coincidence.
I don't think so either.
I think they have determined that Tennessee is a tornado financial risk, and therefore my deductibles and payments are about to go up. And because I got this email, I'm not going to be allowed to bitch about it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I had half a narration biffed by an accidental bump of my soundboard, which activated the monster sound effect on my voice.
And you didn't know until you were done?
I looked up. This is it, after many years in audio, I always have my WAV file visible somewhere. But when you're narrating, you're zoned in on the script, right? Like you're reading through the stuff. And so I narrated, I don't know, a dozen sins or so before I glanced up at the WAV file and was like, and thankfully I noticed the difference in the WAV file. That's another thing about being in audio for so long, is you can see when something changes in the texture of a voice. And it was just a little bit louder, and it was a little bit stockier, like the highs were a little more boxy than usually with a natural voice. So I was like, something's going on there. I thought my volume just got bumped or something. And so then when I listened to it, I was like, oh no, the button got pushed, and all of a sudden all of the audio sounds like this.
It just sounds like this. So my entire narration is just monster voice. Which, the funny part is, I was actually narrating about Rick Sanchez in Bigfoot at the time. So I could have been doing a Bigfoot voice. Who knows?
You could have. Was there a moment where you took your recording of that voice and put it out into the woods and said, "Don't you see we don't want you here anymore?"
Yes. Yes.
Oh, awesome. So, what's new? What's new, Chris? How you loving? Dude. Are you loving being back to work?
I mean, it's sort of. I mean, I sort of lucked out in a sense, because it ended right at the time where the holiday started. So,
right,
it's kind of a de facto seventh month, in a way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. However, once we start writing again, I'll tell you what it feels like once to start writing again.
Yeah.
The very first script that I have to write is one of the hardest ones we've ever had to do, and I have been doing copious amounts of research.
Chris wrote me the other day. He said, "I've bought 8 books on this movie."
Four.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh,
okay.
Wow.
I bought 4 books on this movie that I'm going to read just to make sure I understand things.
Russia first invaded Ukraine last year. Whenever it first happened, yeah. I had a few days of emotional, like, remembrance of the Cold War. And some guy posted on the Nashville subreddit, okay, so Nashville, because of proximity to Clarksville, would probably be a prime target for nuclear assault. So here's what would happen if you lived roughly where Jeremy lives. And here's how you could try and survive. And it requires so much duct tape, and then spending weeks and weeks in a closet, pooping in a paint bucket, and then hoping there's not much radiation in the air when I get out, but there probably will be, and I'll slowly die of sickness. Mm-hmm. And so I remember telling my wife, let's just hug.
Yeah, I think something would kick in with me, not even necessarily survival, but just like curiosity. Like, I don't want to miss the next chapter. Like, that chapter's, you know, as painful as it might be, like, my curiosity would be, can we do it? Like, can we survive it?
Yeah, you may not get to just be a spectator.
What? Come on. That's how the world works.
You may have to get involved, Aaron. We have to pick sides, Texas or California. Which one is it?
Oh my goodness, speaking of apocalyptic movies, have you guys I want to pick your brains on movies, which I guess we will probably do on a certain episode of the show soon, but did you guys see the Sam Esmail End of the World thing on Netflix. I forget what then it's like. Leave the World Behind, maybe.
Leave the World Behind. I have not.
Julia Roberts and Mahershala.
So many headlines about it.
Okay.
Ethan Hawke.
We'll save that discussion then. I'm excited to talk about that movie with
guys. I did watch Murder at the End of the World.
I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that. Is that a TV show or a movie?
Yeah, it was on. It's on Hulu. I guess it's an FX.
Okay.
Whatever. But
Disney. It's all Disney.
Right. I think it's. I think overall, it's good. I'm still thinking about that one. Because it. Yeah. Just.
We're all thinking about the apocalypse. It's on everybody's mind.
Yeah.
For good reason, Aaron.